Okay, thanks very much, Christy, and I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. As you can see from the quote by E.B. White, the mysteries of the corn will not be discussed today. I'm here to discuss the mysteries of the soil, but I'm a plant scientist, so that's my excuse. Also, when I think of colonization, as we heard from Paul, my little hobby farm is on Colonization Road, but that colonization is about something very different. So, anyways, I've taken a real interest in soil, and as a cropping system scientist, how can you not? And the co-authors that I have here are from different Canadian institutions and also from CIMMYT, and they are people who've helped me along the way understand soils and challenging us to introduce new components into our cropping systems. So, in our country and in many places in the world, we've seen this transition in thinking and action from agricultural systems that relied heavily on things like summer fallow all the way to the notion of natural systems agriculture as highlighted by people like Wes Jackson. And so, as an agronomist, I've observed these trends, and in Canada and in many other sort of West, the New World, this is not sort of a unique feature because the scientists and the farmers arrived together, at least the European farmers. There were Aboriginal farmers in Western Canada before the Europeans came along. But when the Europeans arrived, they brought their scientists with them. And we continue to watch what farmers do. We continue to document and try to understand what innovations they're applying. In Manitoba, we hosted Gilbert and Laws from Brothamsted back in the late 1800s. They came to Winnipeg, the Brothamsted archives have Manitoba soil in them. Very high organic matter levels at that level. That's 20%. I don't know what type of bulk density measurements they did, but anyways. And so we monitored what happened, and this was very, very nicely captured in Henry Jansen's paper in the Canadian Journal of Soil Science, which I would recommend anybody interested in agricultural history to read. And the agronomists helped design systems as well. The top picture or graph shows that the year that no-till experiments started in Western Canada, 1892, at two locations. I don't know how well the replication went, but over many years, over about 3 years, scientists looked at no-till. That was the time when they broke the prairie grasses. There were really no weeds, and they could get away with no-tilling, and they were smart enough to figure it out, hey, maybe we should just no-till. And the yields were improved sometimes they weren't quite as good. That data set gives me hope. It inspires me to, with some confidence for some of the natural systems, ideas that we're thinking about now. But in mainstream agriculture in our region, we've gone from a fallow-based system to very much a no-till system. And one of the real benefits is water capture, less water loss through evaporation. And this is something that's been documented in many places. The advantage for us and for African farmers who are using conservation agriculture is that you can plant on time. That's really important. That is a major benefit of conservation agriculture. There's water when you want to seed. In terms of soil microbiology, what scientists in our country figured out is that the biological nitrogen fixation was measured to be higher under no-till than under conventional till. And that was an exciting first step for agronomists into, hey, there's something going on here. And since that time, there's been a lot of work in Canada on how different aspects of our current cropping system, which is mostly no-till, affects the soil biology and biochemistry. And I called the soil biology and biochemistry the new kid on the block because it isn't it true that it's the newest of the soil sciences after soil physics and soil chemistry? And so some of these studies have already been mentioned this morning, but people have looked at crop rotation effects, residue management, some early adoption. There's Alan, our next speaker, did some work in Canada. That was nice. Nitrogen fertilizer rates, And then some of the new inputs, glyphosate, fungicides, insecticides, paraquat, and more recently people have looked at liming. So we have a pretty good understanding of how the system comes to bear on the soil biological community. But I want to turn our attention to some of the challenges in this production paradigm and how it might change our thinking about soil biology. The grain-based no-till system has some challenges, and herbicide resistance is a small challenge. One of the big ones is weather, especially these inundating rains which happen. What May was the wettest month in the history of the world last year or the last few years. That's when we plant our crops. That's giving us a real challenge. And when we look at our region, which was grassland, maybe it's not such a surprise that we're having trouble with excess water, because the prairie had very deep-rooted plants. This is, I think, from Nebraska. I think Weaver was from Nebraska, if I'm not wrong. And, look at those forbs going down 7 meters. And we removed those deep-rooted plants, and we're paying the price. And the Australians have had the same problem where their hydrology disruption has caused tremendous salinization problems. Now, we can turn that around and say perennial phases can cure many of the problems of grain-based no-till systems. And also, as Lynn mentioned, it may put some carbon down deeper than the surface layer, which is where we're stocking the carbon right now. I want to share just this one data set that we generated a few years ago. We had a piece of land at the university farm which had high nitrates, right down to 300 centimeters, and we grew alfalfa, and we measured how the alfalfa could extract, or the lucerne that could extract the nitrate from the soil. And we had some other rotations as part of it. And much to our surprise, after 6 years, we had extracted a fair bit of the nitrate, but the rotation of lucerne or alfalfa and grain actually resulted in the lowest nitrate concentration deep in the profile than the continuous alfalfa or certainly the grain-only system. The conclusion there was, for subsoil nitrogen circumstances, the rotation was better. This is encouraging. Rotations are important. What this is due to, the way the biopores are explored, the attrition in the alfalfa plants, these are all possible causes. But I think what we've learned is perennials are useful, and perennials rotated with annuals may be useful. The other role of perennials is for weed management. This is from our long-term Glenlee plot. You can see under organic management, adding forage hay phases into the system does a much better job of controlling weeds. No big surprise. Okay, turning to some soil biology. This is data from in year 20 of our Glenlee study. And Here, this was a measure of microbial biomass carbon in two farming systems, the forage grain rotation and the grain-only rotation. And what I wanted to point out here is that we got a boost in organic microbial biomass carbon in our organic systems, both with manure, and with compost, and without. But we did not see that in the grain-only system. We actually saw a decrease in microbial biomass carbon that was statistically significant. Now, those compost rates were very, very low because we were just supplying the phosphorus, which wasn't being mined out very heavily in this system. So this is actually, this is my first question for myself and for you, is there a minimum level of carbon fertilization required for organic systems to function? And I had the great pleasure of traveling around Africa with Roland Bunch, who some of you may have heard of, done a lot of work with green manure cover crops. And he, through his observations, has concluded or has been thinking about why there are no phosphorus responses on tropical soils when they have a lot of carbon going into them. And so is the same thing happening here? That's a question that we can talk about. Okay, cover cropping. This is another innovation that's coming our way. A lot of interest in the Great Plains and other parts of the world. One of the first questions that we had to ask, and it's pretty relevant for this very chilly room. I'm freezing. That's why I'm shaking. I'm really not that nervous. A little bit nervous, but I'm freezing. You know, how much heat and water is available after harvest? And the winter wheat crops, which we now grow in Western Canada quite regularly, they really facilitate cover cropping. They open up that window, and we've calculated some of those probabilities. The big problem we have is cover crop seed costs. Here we have a picture of hairy vetch seeded after winter wheat. It's a great crop, works well. It's very expensive. That's about, you know, $30, $40 an acre. And so Soleil Turmel, who's now working with CIMMYT in Costa Rica, has really got us started on some ideas about self-regenerating cover crops. And the idea of using self-regenerating cover crops took me to Australia, where I had the chance to learn about biological soil fertility from Lynn. And then when I, you know, we were always wondering what species to grow, and we tried the Australian species, and they grew well, but they didn't regenerate because their seed coats were cued from different things. They were in a Mediterranean climate, were temperate. I went to Rothamsted in 2000 and went to their no fertilizer, no weed killer plots, and what did I see? Metacagua lupulina, an adapted medic. And so for all those reasons, we started working with not the Australian medics that, you know, I thought about a lot when I was working in Australia, but the medics that were growing right in our backyard. So it's, how do they say, it's like coming home for the first time. And so together with colleagues, we set up two long-term trials where we put self-regenerating medics into no-till systems, let them regenerate, and applied herbicides, applied fertilizers. And Bill May, who's in the audience, he is based at Indian Head, and he'll be giving his poster on Wednesday. There's the number, so you want, or his paper. Sure, sorry. So you you want to talk to him about that. What we noticed after, I think, about 5 years of the medics living as an understory, they already improved the nitrogen supplying power of the soil as based on this little simple assay. So that's one way of getting the cover crop into the system without having to pay the seed cost every year. And it's an intriguing, it's very intriguing to me, and I think there's still work to be done for our country. I want to shift talking about cover crops in the tropics. This is work you probably are familiar with, the conservation agriculture movement in tropical countries, basically just putting a mulch on the surface to conserve soil. It's very effective. The problem is, as many of you will know, sometimes those residues are eaten by termites. Sometimes it's difficult to find that enough residue to actually provide the water-conserving mulch. And so there's efforts going on to test those things. And Isaiah at CIMMYT is working on that, and we've just started a project with them, really taking some of the concepts that were, you know, well, you can't take the concepts from the temperate areas to the tropics. It's a completely different situation. Everything recycles on the top. But looking at legume integration, using the legumes to produce the mulch, basically, by retuning them and having them regrow. And there are so many legumes to choose from, and they do such wonderful things like hydrolifting, which Paul and I talked about last night with pigeon pea. That is an area that I think all of us can think about a bit more. Coming back home, we're in the cropping system design business, so we work with lots of different farmers, and our no-till farmers, when the environmental movement got started, said, you know, we don't want to be organic, but how about if we just reduce our pesticides, you know, 1 year and four, and sell our crops? And so there was this movement that started, and we published, you can read the story if you would like. But the important thing about the work, there was many important things we worked on farms, but we also set up some long-term studies where we skipped herbicides in certain years, and these were no-till studies where herbicides were skipped 1 year and four, 2 years and four. And since then, Rob Golden has joined our University of Manitoba, by the way. I'm not at the University of Winnipeg, I'm at the University of Manitoba. And he is, you know, taken over these studies and is very intrigued with the weed seed bank that is built up in these systems. So we have a herbicide all the time, herbicide skipped 1 year and four, and herbicides skipped 2 years and four, and these are the seed banks that have built up. So those are pretty high seed banks. And first of all, I should say Rob views these seed banks as carbon sources, which is intriguing. I've never thought of weed seed banks as carbon sources, but I think that's a useful thing. And what Rob is interested in is how these weeds in the system have actually affected the soil biology, because they're really a cover crop. And they're, again, addressing the cover crop costs. Weeds grow. Why not use them as cover crops? So he has grown some durum wheat and soils from these rotations after 14 years and has discovered some, you know, very interesting things. As you can see, the mycorrhizal colonization is higher. He's measured higher Olson P levels in these soils. And as Paul was talking about the denitrification community, he's working together with a Scottish group in Dundee on these nitrification genes and finding that these cover crops are resulting in a healthier system, allowing that reaction to go all the way to N2. And he's also finding higher canola yields. And these higher canola yields have been measured for the duration of the study. When we skip herbicides 1 year out of four, the canola yields are statistically significantly higher. And so it's a very intriguing question. Here's another question about cropping system design and microbiology. This comes from a group of Agriculture Canada colleagues at Swift Current, Saskatchewan. They just published this. I have a copy of the paper with me if you'd like to see it. But I thought they really asked a fabulous, you know, they monitored about 78 farms across the prairie region, organic, conventional, and they came to the conclusion here in this quote that there's one of the problems with these organic systems is that there is insufficient carbon assimilation, which in the wheat seedlings that are seeded into these organic systems, and that may be that's limiting their yield. And the reason there is so much competition is because the soil biology in the organic system is so much higher than the conventional system, which we've been hearing about this morning. And these are just spores of the mycorrhiza associations that our Glenleaf study. And so these are some of the recommendations they made at the end of the paper. Have you ever heard of a recommendation to reduce, you know, microbial mycorrhiza? Yeah, it's the first time I've heard somebody suggest that. But what I want to talk about next is how we might respond to that as agronomists. And we have some ideas on rotations to overcome this carbon limitation in these organic systems. And this is one that we've been working on for 9 years. It is to create a marriage between plant biology and the weather, and to find species and varieties within species that grow well in niches and winter kill. So instead of using, you know, instead of trying to keep plants alive, we want the winter to kill them. This happens to be a winter kill hairy vetch mulch, which we're using to zero till into. And this does overcome these limitations. But I think it's a really intelligent question that they asked in this paper. It's real. These seedlings in these organic systems, in the phosphorus-limited soils that we have, they can really struggle, and there's a whole bunch of reasons for that carbon competition. But as agronomists, you know, we need to keep asking ourselves, how can we design systems to overcome these limitations as opposed to giving up? The other approach that we've taken, one that I'm really excited about to deal with this carbon competition, is actually to breed, not only breed varieties for organic production, but do the selections on organic fields. And so we've been fortunate to get quite a large grant from a foundation to give us a shot in the arm with this work. And so what we do, working together with breeders of oats, wheat, and potato, is we put the F2 segregating populations right onto farm fields. And here's an example of wheat on an organic farm, and here's an example of oats, and the farmer actually making, the farmers make both the negative and the positive selections, and they select for 3 consecutive years. And we're working with 44 farmers across the country, from the Maritimes all the way to Vancouver Island. We started off with 11 farmers, and after 3 years of selections, we had seed from them. We grew it in a common garden. This is all organic production in Manitoba. And, you know, the farmers had selected for slight, you know, higher yield. But I'm wondering if the farmers are selecting for the, you know, what is happening in the rhizosphere. When these segregating populations are facing this carbon competitive environment that has been described as being real on at least some organic farms, I can't help but thinking that there's some really good news in the rhizosphere. And if any of you microbiologists want to, you know, samples of these populations, phone me, email me. Okay, I want to end off with sort of the top rung on this ladder, and that's natural systems agriculture. I think this is where we got to go. This is our future. We need to have a more oil independent, a more, you know, less fossilized agriculture, and this is going to take a radical shift. But we can do it. Just like those agronomists in 1892, you know, maybe we're at 1898 when it comes to natural systems agriculture. I want to just go through what we know that might help us actually formulate a decent system. I mean, we know that nutrients need to be recycled. This is from our Glenlee study. We're in a phosphorus-limited area. When we do not add compost, we can't make nitrogen. Right? That's our alfalfa plots where we don't add, nothing grows. It's that dramatic. How do we capture the nutrients that we're recycling? Well, we'll leave capturing urban nutrients, which we need to think about just for the moment. This is work from Mark Powell in West Africa. And he's at USDA, I think, at the Dairy Research Center. He's very interested in should we, you know, bring the manure out of the barn and put it on the field, or do corralling. And you can see by the red bars that corralling the animals on the field is going to result in higher yields, because you're probably capturing more of the nitrogen. And we also know that by having animals consume forages, preferably directly through grazing, results in healthier products for healthier food products, milk, meat, cheese. Because that data is now quite overwhelming. And I'm really happy to see that in my city I could buy pasture butter this summer, because I knew it was better for me and my family. I know Alan is going to talk about livestock integration, but this is something that is really relevant to our part of the world where it's almost as cold as this room. You can all do jumping jacks if you want, like I feel like doing it. But when we think about soil biology, you know, we have these dormant periods, right? And here in Australia, they have 6 months of dry weather, in California as well, and we have six months of where there's not enough heat to run the microbes, most of them anyways. And so the rumen is really, we see it as portable soil. It can process carbon-rich foods after the soil biology stops. So biology doesn't have to stop when the soil biology stops. And our farm, we're doing a lot of winter grazing on the Great Plains now. People don't use barns anymore. They haven't for a long time. They put up wind fences. Cattle are out all year. And calving is delayed now. Half of the calf herd in Manitoba is calving in June as opposed to February. And that all fits into the grass-finished ruminant production system. It's very exciting. But I wanted to make this point that we can process carbon even in the off-season. Now, the other thing that we know is trees are important, and we heard that this morning as well. There's a lot of carbon in those trees. In southern Australia, trees are sometimes used to rebalance the hydrology, which is necessary for salinity control. In southern Africa, the amazing Phaidarbia tree, which is a reverse phenology tree, can help to moderate climate and add nitrogen. I'll explain just for a minute. This is a nitrogen-fixing tree that loses its leaves native to the area, loses its leaves at the beginning of the rainy season, enriching the soil with its nitrogen-rich leaves, is leafless during the crop establishment period, and then it leafs out when the maize is tasseling and requires some temperature modification and shade giving some heat relief. And the density of the trees really dictate what kind of temperature modification you want. This is helpful. These are Phidarabia trees, not on a research farm, but on a farm. Farmers are using them once they understand or relearn the value of them. And so this is one thing we know, trees can be helpful. The other thing that we know is perennial grains are on the horizon. There's a session, unfortunately, exactly at the same time as this one. At our university, we have hired a perennial grain breeder, Doug Catani, and we work very closely with the Land Institute and the international colleagues. That's Lee DeHaan and Stan Cox there on the upper right. I love the fact that the Land Institute doesn't do any proprietary rights business on their seeds. Anybody who wants their seeds gets them and can continue to select. And so Doug has selected Kernza, which is a large seed intermediate wheatgrass type, for 3 years in Manitoba in our cold conditions. And we now were able to plant. Last autumn we planted about an acre of Kernza, and we're testing it in a dual purpose system with grain production and then post-residue livestock grazing. So putting all of these things together, these are some of the things that I think about and that my group thinks about in terms of designing natural systems that use multiple components and emphasize those synergistic processes. This picture was taken by my former PhD student Haroon Sysak in Brazil, where Alan had and colleagues had organized a very nice crop livestock integration conference, and you can see the trees are planted. There are strips of crops of annual crops. And I drew this. Can you tell it's hand drawn? Those are my trees, and we in our work at what we call the Sunshine Farm at the U of M, we want to reduce our fossil fuel use to 15% of current. We're at 35%. And the last 20% to go up from 35 to 15, we have a couple of rules, a couple of principles that we're working on. Animals can be in the system, but they have to work. They can't, like, none of this bringing them their lunch and cleaning up their room, right? Like that's, you know what happens when you do that for teenagers. You know? I kind of think my mother did that for me, but anyways. So the animals have to work, and we've actually played around with some nighttime corralling where we have the animals in an area and we bring them into another area at night and have them do their business to move nutrients. No diesel fuel tractors, despite the wonderful Kubota commercials that speak to my diesel fuel gene. In terms of phosphorus, yes, we always get questioned in organic agriculture, you're phosphorus limited. Well, we now know that there's a lot of organic phosphorus in these systems, but the deep-rooted perennials can lift some of those nutrients, and we can move them out with animals. We're going to get some import. You get the picture. And this is just a small example of that. So thank you for allowing me a chance to talk about some of our ideas and experiences going up this ladder. And I just want to thank you as soil microbiologists, ecologists, that for helping out, because a deeper understanding of soil biology and ecology is really important for cropping system design, and we should continue to work together. Thanks.